cliffcentral.com.
Nice. Yeah, it's Alok Bhaskar and Fuego. Do you like it?
Alok Bhaskar.
So I know Amanda likes this. You like it, huh?
That's my favorite song.
You're kidding.
That's my favorite song.
Really?
Nailed it, DJ. I saw you looked at me. I could see you recognized this as something special.
Yeah.
Yeah. I could see you dancing all weekend to that. All right. It is Monday morning. We're going to have Peter Louis Myberg in just now, the author of The Republic of Gupta, the story of state capture, which I read over the weekend. Interesting stuff. Ben has also been catching up on what all of our listeners are doing. See, just like you listen to us, we also check in on you.
Not in a creepy way.
No, but Ben follows some of our more prolific and interesting listeners on social media.
We have some fascinating people who interact with the show. And like, good point, Gareth. Like, people always say, you know, the show is such a big part of our lives now. But some of our listeners are fantastically interesting people.
I mean, you check in on Simba, who's in California.
And Simba's Instagram account is one of the funniest things on the internet.
He posted some picture of him playing golf, and he's like, so how's your day going?
But his golf cart was stuck in a ditch in the bushes.
And then there's High Rob in Amsterdam.
He's going through some good times right now. He'll call in sometime soon.
All right.
But there's just fascinating people who share their time with us.
And then I just got this update from somebody too. Angela Merkel used to be a nudist.
Here we go.
Oh.
Yes. And there are pictures of Angela Merkel nackt, freik.
Let's see what Google's got to say about that.
Yeah.
Go on. Take a look. See if you can find some naked.
Check who's sitting behind me.
Yeah. Go on. Let's see Angela Merkel.
You people are so sick.
Yeah, a little bit. So what?
Ben called it. He said this, so you know, they say in Afrikaans, stille waters diepe grond, which means if the waters are quiet on the surface, it means that the lake is deep. There's stuff going on at the bottom you don't know about. Oh, look at that. Angela Merkel wandering around naked.
Yeah, with her friends.
She didn't have too bad a body when she was younger.
But what?
Not a bad looking woman.
So I don't. Okay. So what exactly does it mean, though, to be a member of a nudist colony? So you all live together in a separate place,
Germans,
or what?
Germans love that stuff.
Yeah,
they've got nudist colonies all over Germany, apparently. And the Germans, wherever they go, they try to find nude beaches to go to. They like that a lot. It's nudist thing. I don't know where it comes from. It must be from their ancient.
It's because summers are so short.
Past.
Summers are so short, so you got to get in there.
You got to make the most of it, huh?
But she still has that cheeky grin, does old Angela.
Well, good for her. I totally misread this. I thought Angela was kind of boring and conservative.
No, well, she's German.
Oh, that's a wild streak in all of them. Angela Merkel. My God. Doing all kinds of filthy stuff. Well, you see,
So do you want to take back what her response would really be then, Ben, if she walked into my dungeon?
No, I think she's spot on.
I think when she saw Justin Trudeau's pink socks, she was like, Justin, I have some suspenders at home which are very much more interesting than that. Yeah, boring. Anyway, hey, I'm going to be in Germany in like 2 weeks' time, so I'll see whether I can find out more about Angela. Maybe I bump into her in a nude resort.
Why are you going there again?
I'm going over to make a speech, and I'm part of a panel on free speech in Africa and in the developing world. There'll be a lot of interesting people. There are apparently some very high-profile people because you have to do a security check on you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's in Bonn.
And how long are you gone for?
7 days.
So you'll be missing...
I'll be missing a week. And 1 day.
Okay.
Yeah.
Will we be able to check in with you?
Yeah, the time difference is very... I don't think there is a time difference, so yeah.
I think that's pretty much spot on.
We can check in every morning. It should be good. And I will speak German to you. No, I can't... This is the problem, is I can't speak any German. I've been to France before. I can understand a little bit and speak some. But the Germans... I believe everyone speaks English there anyway. It's like in Holland. Everybody speaks English. You don't need to speak Dutch. I mean, you know, High Rob has been... He's been living there for years already. He doesn't speak any Dutch. Someone says, yep, here we go. Gareth, the Afrikaans idiom you just referred to actually is stille waters diepe grond, onder kruip die duivel rond. So, still waters, deep ground, underneath the devil goes round. That's more or less what it is. That's from the fact checker. And he says, someone else says, sorry, not the fact checker, but yeah, these Germans always taking off their clothes.
Okay.
Steve says, free speech rocks. Yeah, that's what I'm going over there to talk about. And Graham says, Justin is a snowflake. I suppose you mean Justin from Canada? Justin Trudeau. Have you had a look at pictures of him?
His hairstyle is stupid.
Let's see if there are any other opinions here. Let's go to Amanda and to Balissa this morning and see whether they agree. Huh? What do we think? No? What do you think?
Not... I think he's really gorgeous.
Oh, wow. Okay, yeah. Amanda's going straight
there
for the...
There was quite a cool picture of him, like, with his shirt off and his tattoo. Like, it was quite cool.
He's got a tattoo.
Yeah.
Huh. All right. Well, there we go. So there's someone who loves him. any other opinions in that room? No?
No.
Yeah, if maybe Sia.
Yeah, maybe Sia is going to be the arbiter. Sia will be the final tester.
Yeah, I got to find out what's going on there.
I reckon Sia will give him a thumbs up.
Anyway, Justin Trudeau, supposedly the best looking man in politics in the world.
Justin from Canada.
Yeah, sorry. That's what I meant.
Just imagine Justin from Canada, go ahead.
No, that's kind of how it works. Come on in. Let's get Peter Louis Myberg in here and start talking to him about his book, which is called The Story of State Capture, The Republic of Gupta. It's available in good bookstores now. Right now, though, there isn't a bigger story in South Africa than this family and what they've done. And yesterday, breaking news about a bunch of emails that have been leaked that show just how deep state capture goes. So this book covers where it all started, the capture of South African cricket, the nuclear procurement deal, the hiring and firing of cabinet ministers, Jacob Zuma's rise to power, and even AJ Gupta being in Thabo Mbeki's secret advisory council, which, of course, the Thabo Mbeki Foundation was not pleased to have had revealed. A little while ago, they were very keen to point out that this was not what they said it wasn't true. They said he wasn't involved with the Mbeki administration at all. But it seems that there's a lot of confusion around this. What a time to have written this book. What a time to have the reputation that you have developed for being the man who's investigated every deep, dark secret of the Gupta family. How are you, Peter Louis Myberg?
I'm well, thanks, Gareth. Thanks for having me.
Sure, man. Nice to have you here. Yeah, we got the book, what, 2-3 weeks ago, and I speed read through it over the weekend because there's quite a lot of detail in here. You've gone to a lot of trouble. Just to get people in the picture, you have written extensively about the process situation and how dodgy that is. Mm. You've also written plenty of articles for the Beelton Report in the past. You now work for News 24. Did you have time, because there was a lot of research that had to go into this,
yeah.
Did you have a lot of time to put this book together?
You know, actually, it was actually, the timing was fantastic on behalf of the publishers. So they actually, interestingly, they approached me after the PRASA fiasco of 2015.
Mm.
So towards the end of 2015, actually, they already came to me and said that, listen, they kind of view the Guptas as a worthwhile topic to unpack in a sort of, in a book, you know, in a longer narrative. Which was fantastic timing, because that was even before these massive state capture allegations that occurred in March 2016, you know, when Mthembisi Jonas and Fakey Mentor came out with those indications of the Guptas offering them jobs and stuff. Mm-hmm. So I had a bit of about a year and 4 months, more or less, almost a year and a half. Would have liked more always, but yeah, I think we managed to compile quite a nice little, you know, little narrative of the Gupta saga up until that point.
It's not little, it's substantial. I mean, you go all the way back. Let's just, before we get into the history of this, the Gupta family and their influence on the state, let's just look at what's happened over the weekend, because there were these very revealing emails that suddenly came out. Can you tell me what you make of this, especially with the context of the history of this family and the relationship to the president? Are these emails a revelation to you, or are they pretty much what you expected?
No, I think absolutely they're revelatory. I've been privileged enough to get the sort of the tranche or the cachet of documents myself now, which we'll start working through, but it's absolutely immense. I can
There's
tell you
more,
that.
In other words.
I gather the two Sunday papers who ran the story on Sunday, they received the documents quite late, I assume. And I think they probably just dug in there and quickly sort of picked a couple of points they could report on over the weekend. But if I look at the size of the sort of the document tranche, you know, there's definitely going to be a lot more that's going to come out as we start, you know, going into the details of these emails. There's a lot I've been up. It's like I don't know, it's tempting to abandon your weekend plans and just dig into these emails immediately, which I've done a bit yesterday, and I've certainly spotted a couple of very interesting emails already.
Now, how did this happen? Because Mabali and I were speculating this morning. Did someone inside the circle of trust leak these? Was it a hack? What happened with Hillary Clinton and the Russians? Was this something that was purposely put out there? Because, you know, a lot of theories go around the fact that this timing was interesting with the NEC meeting over the weekend.
No, absolutely. Look, I think it's obviously one of two options. It's pure coincidence, or, you know, it was planted specifically in the media to possibly influence the outcome of the weekend's NEC proceedings.
That's what the Gupta lawyer said as well.
They would like us to believe that. But I think, you know, we'd learn more details of that later, I'm sure. But what I can definitely say is that, you know, having spoken to people within the Gupta fold, or like former associates of the family, there's definitely also growing sentiment from within their own ranks that, you know, that what they are getting up to is not above board, it's not okay. So I wouldn't be surprised if these kind of whistleblower actions start occurring more frequently even from now onwards.
I was talking to Justice Malala about how expensive this network of patronage must be for the Guptas. They've made a lot of money. Do we have any idea how much they've made out of South Africa?
Yeah, well, we can at least pinpoint the wealth of one of the brothers, the middle brother, Atul Gupta, who's said to be worth around 10.5 billion rand, which he's amassed in quite a short space of time. So that doesn't even include the other two Gupta brothers or the rest of the extended family. It also doesn't reflect on their property outside of the country. We know there's at least one mansion in Dubai worth around 500 million rand. So this 10 billion rand is basically, it reflects the shareholding in locally held JSC companies.
Oh, that's all?
Just of Atul Gupta.
Just
so
that?
There must be much, much more. I think, yeah, we're looking at a figure of at least 10 billion rand just to one brother. So it must be way more than that.
What clever people. I mean, what clever people. We can hate them all we like, but they saw an opportunity here. They found a man who was pliable.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And they know he just needs money because he's got a problem understanding debit and credit.
Yeah, I hope it's not this book is, you know, on the one hand, obviously a lot of people view it as a very frightening expose of their exploits, but I hope it's not do-it-yourself manual for get rich quick scheme. They certainly are very crafty. They're very cunning, and if you look at the way that they've sort of like planned the capture of the state, you know, and just usurping the ANC structures, I think it's definitely something to at least a certain extent to tip your hat to, I suppose, just in strategy terms.
Don't you think they've made so much money now, and the water's starting to get hot? And it's maybe becoming a little bit uncomfortable for them. Do you think that they should just cash out? I mean, do you think they will just cash out and just disappear?
Yeah, you know, you always look at these movies on, like, say, like American Gangster, you know, the Denzel Washington movie, and you always wonder, like, why do these guys not just, like, bail out? You know, they've made
a killing.
X amount of money. Yeah. When you actually, but I think it's a character trait, these guys. I think that's, like, the universal sort of, like, the thing that binds all of these type of personalities together is their insatiable desire and need to be in power and to keep on making loads and loads of money. So I think the money thing is just like absolutely irresistible to them. They're going to try and, especially with the nuclear deal sort of on the horizon, I think they want that. That's the end game. You know, they want to get in there. There's going to be so much money to be made from that. So I do not see them stepping away just yet.
Where did the whole relationship with the Guptas and politics start? Because they're not from South Africa.
Yeah, so the middle brother, Atul Gupta, arrives here in South Africa in about 1993. Mm-hmm. And then very interestingly, it didn't take him long to kind of cozy up to the likes of Esso Pahad, who was a minister in former President Thabo Mbeki's office. And from there on, you know, the relationship just grew. And it's very interesting also how early on, actually, in sort of the grander narrative, they roped in Dudu Zani Zuma into their business empire, you know. I think the accounts sometimes are a bit contrasting, or they're not exactly sure when what happened, but Dudu Zani Zuma has said that he met the Guptas in 2001 and his father introduced them to him. So they had
He must have been a teenager. He was about 19,
if I'm not mistaken, when he started there as a trainee IT manager at Sahara Computers. So that's a very, very early on, there was this investment seemingly in the Gupta family, in the Zuma family. Which is so interesting if you consider how it sort of panned out, you know. at that stage, Zuma didn't really look like a front runner to ever become ANC president. So that's what's concerning and frightening to me, is the fact that they seem to be willing to invest in this family. Did they foresee Zuma's rise to power, or did they actively sort of, you know,
help make
pull
it happen.
Some strings behind the scenes to make it happen? Yeah.
Well, clearly there was a relationship of convenience here early on, and the president, obviously, why does he need them, and why do they need him? Let's delineate this. We can go back to the Thabo Mbeki stuff later.
Yeah, I think.
Why do they need each other?
I think, in short, the reciprocity is that, you know, he's in power. He makes decisions on the appointment of key figures to the boards of companies like Eskom and Transnet, which interestingly has become the piggy banks, you know, to a large extent, of the Gupta companies. So I think, in short, if you look at Jacob Zuma as a character as well, you know, he's always been somebody who's been dependent on this, the financial benefits of these shady characters, going back to Shabir Sheikh and now the Guptas too. So he definitely is somebody who seems to maintain a rather lavish lifestyle. He's got a very big family. So he needs money, in short, if you have to put
it. And these guys will help him get his hands on the money. All he has to do is make decisions that benefit him.
And they obviously they need him to place these people in his board so that the contracts and tenders can go their way.
There must be a lot of money in it for him, though. Do we have any idea? Because according to the president's balance sheet, he's bankrupt.
Yeah, he is. And that's what's been so convenient for them thus far. You know, he could always sort of proclaim this supposed arm's length relationship between him and the Guptas. But I mean, going back again to Didi Zani Zuma, he's the guy who rakes in the money on behalf of the Zuma family.
And how much have we got here?
Well, if you purely look at sort of his investments, you know, he's in Mabangela Investments, and that sort of gave him an in into this whole Tegeta coal deal with the Guptas and Eskom and everything. I mean, you're looking at least probably around just these sort of recent deals, about 500 million rand, probably half a billion rand, just from the sort of Eskom things. That's not the end of his sort of business ties to the Guptas. There are others as well, but he's definitely worth a couple of hundred million rand.
What a life this guy must have. He must drive around in fancy cars and laugh and think, well, I've really landed with my ass in the butter. My dad's the president. I've got these Guptas giving me just piles of money because I'm the conduit. And I don't necessarily have to be good at anything even. I've met the guy, and I don't think he's unintelligent.
He's
certainly a very smart, very charming young man. But right in the middle of all of this is him.
He's
the guy who connects them.
The Afrikaans expression, met die gat in die botter geval, comes to mind. You know, he literally fell in the butter. And it's just such a great position for him to be in. He's definitely, as you put out, you know, he's definitely also a very crafty individual. And one can only wonder, you know, what somebody like that could achieve if he chose the straight and narrow, I suppose. But it's just so much easier. But, you know, having said the sort of all the, you mentioned all the benefits that come his way, I also wonder if there's at least a little seed of sort of doubt in his mind as to the long-term viability of all of this. Because surely, you know, I think the general consensus is that the lifeline or the end date for all of this has to be coincide with the end of President Jacob Zuma's tenure as president of South Africa. Unless they manage to sort of again, you know, pull correct strings and, you know, see to it that the succession battle ends in such a manner that it's a pro-Zuma faction person who takes over the party.
I mentioned earlier that the cost of this network of patronage must be huge. They have to pay off a lot of people. We know about the big names like Msebenzi Zwane, Faith Mutambi. We know Koko at Eskom. We know Ben Gubane, those kind of people. But how many people are the Guptas paying on a month? And what's their salary bill like? I say salary in inverted commas.
Absolutely, yeah. Because you have
the bribery bill, like.
You have the official above board salary sort of bill of the Sahara Computers and Oakba and all of those companies. But then as these emails and leaks start to continue coming out, I think we're going to learn more and more about how deeply entrenched their tentacles are into the shadow state. You know, these are the people that have to pay. I mean, we've only seen the tip of the iceberg now. You know, we know that, you know, there were trips to Dubai for Msebenzi Zwane and Koko from Eskom and Desmond and all of them. But I'm sure, you know, as time goes on and we learn more, we're going to see even more sort of compelling evidence of back room and, you know, under the table payments to a lot of people they need in those positions, because
the Premier League?
The Premier League as well. I mean, Ace Magashule's son is very much inserted into the Gupta business empire, much in the same manner as Dirizani was inserted there too. So if you look at the behavior of a lot of these people, it just doesn't make sense for them to literally bend over backwards to, you know, to comply to the whims of the Guptas. For no reason. That would be very strange. You know, there has to be some sort of a beneficiation somehow, or benefit flowing to them. I'm sure.
Can we go back again to the beginning? One of the first targets for the Guptas was cricket. How did they get involved in that, and what was the level of their involvement, and how did it start becoming a situation of cricket capture?
Sure. That was a fun chapter to work on for me, because I think like a lot of this stuff is quite heavy, you know, it's sort of like politics centered, and it was quite fun to you know, sort of just momentarily depart from the broader political scene and just go into sport a little bit, which is
these are the level one and two captures. Once they knew they could do those, they could move on to level three.
Almost like a practice run. Yeah. You know, so they definitely, again, quite early on, in the early 2000s, they started out by sponsoring or getting the naming rights to Sahara Park Newlands and Sahara Park, the St. George's Oval in Port Elizabeth and Kingsmead in Durban. And it's also very interesting how they kind of like, they always say that it's going to be some sort of a charitable movement. You know, they're aiding Cricket South Africa, you know, they're pouring money into the sport. But then it's always a situation a couple of months later, then Cricket South Africa releases a statement where they say that Sahara Computers has now clinched a contract to supply CSA with computers for 5 years, you know. So it's always the first.
There's no such thing as a free lunch.
Yeah, no, definitely. You know, and these guys, it's also it's a fun case study of capture. You know, they definitely got right into the CSA board. There's been situations where the guys met at the Saxon World compound on the evening before Cricket South Africa board meetings, which once again just leads us to believe that they probably sort of determined the outcome of the actual, you know, above board meeting at Saxon World already. In the same way that President Zuma goes there and determines the future of our country.
What about these revelations this weekend? And it must tie into what you've already written in the book about how these ministers get brought in to the shadow state, so to speak, the network.
Yeah, I think that's probably for me sort of the most frightening manifestation of state capture.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that at the very highest echelons of our government, you know, these guys step in and make these profound job offers, you know, and rope in the likes of Jonas and Mentor in the presence of Jacob Zuma. So I think that speaks to such a large extent to the audacity of their capture exploits and just how brazen and shameless they've become in these things. I mean, I think there's been a lot of sort of, obviously they're going to step out and say it's fake news, which they've done now with the latest revelations. But the body of evidence is just growing and growing to such a, you know, to such a mass of indications of state capture that it's going to become very difficult for them in the future to just brush all of this off as fake news.
And they can't bank in South Africa anymore.
Which is very interesting. I wonder how they pay their employees. I mean, at least their formal official
systems,
employees. Yeah, because no, definitely. I mean, the last banking lifeline they had was the Bank of Baroda from India, and they've also cut ties with the Guptas. So even so, their sort of staunchest business associates, if you look at Bell Pottinger, their infamous public relations team from the UK, they've also cut ties with the family. So
now tell me about
banking.
Tell me about Bell Pottinger, because this is also interesting. They were busy showing Colin Maine and some other people how they should respond to press and media inquiries and this kind of thing. I mean, this organization basically aided and abetted the capture of the state.
Yeah.
And then at some point they decided, whoa, these guys are even too poisonous for us.
Yeah.
And Who are they? I mean, what have you discovered about Bell Pottinger?
It says quite a lot about the company. You know, they've done some sort of very interesting and controversial work in terms of military contractors US military contractors going into countries like Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, so they have been known to kind of like do work for people who are viewed, at least by the public, as being shady. So it seemed a perfect fit for them to go and come and help the Guptas. You know, I think what the emails, especially the weekend's emails leak now shows, is the fact that what has previously been denied, you know, these sort of indications that the Guptas direct the political stance and utterances of an organization like the ANC Youth League. That is very much the case. If you look at these little bullet points, I went into some of those emails, you know, they literally, it's like a nice little PowerPoint presentation almost for how Colin Mahine, ANC Youth League leader, should respond when he is asked about the Guptas, for instance.
Which, ironically, he was over the weekend.
Exactly, exactly. So I hope he kept some of the notes they sent him. But, you know, it's just quite frightening how, you know, that's why I think, so like, there's been some criticism on my book in terms of how we depicted the role between the Guptas and President Zuma, you know, him being this passive sort of role player puppet, just being sort of like strung along, you know. But if you look at these emails, you know, Bell Pottinger definitely, and I mean, they are agents of the Guptas in the scenario.
Yeah.
They were very directly directing the ANC in their conduct and how they should respond to state capture allegations. So
I mean, is there anything more colonial than the masters, the white masters in London, busy telling the ANC how it should behave? There's never been a more embarrassing kind of blot on their copybook. Yeah. How close did you get to the Guptas? I mean, how many people are willing to talk about them? And you said earlier that you've got some people who are now starting to come out of the woodwork and there are leaks happening. But how close did you manage to get? And were you threatened? Because we know that they have no problem getting dirty if they need to.
Yeah. No, I think sort of like if ever they were threats, it would have been more sort of tacit almost or implied.
Did you get offered 600 million like KBC Jonas?
Yeah, if that were the case, it wouldn't be a book today.
All right, so tell me how close you got.
Yeah, so yeah, definitely. I was lucky enough to sort of find a couple of former and possibly current Gupta associates, so these people who did business with him, especially on the early on when they landed, arrived in South Africa and needed to broaden their business network here. So that was quite interesting. People who dealt with him very closely quite early on and were therefore sort of privy to the expansion or the growth of the Gupta empire. That was very interesting to me. And then also some other people who...
I mean, I'm not asking you to reveal your sources, but I mean, are there people now who are willing to speak out? Are there people who are very clearly not impressed with what's going on and feel it's now time to open up? Not the ones who we already publicly know about, like Fakie Mentor and all of those.
Yeah, I think definitely. I think especially from within the actual Gupta fold. Not on the record at this stage, possibly at a later date, you know, as a I think there's going to be a growing confidence in speaking out against the Guptas. I think people are still a little bit afraid. But I think as this sort of tide grows against the Guptas, which it definitely is, if you look at the weekend's developments, I think people will become more and more comfortable to actually reveal what really happened. And I mean, once again, I think we probably only know the tip of the iceberg, so there's going to be much, much more.
What happened to Nazim Hawa? I mean, why did that go badly?
Yeah, he unfortunately is not one of my sources. I did try to contact him.
You would have
him.
Some stories.
I tried my level
best. But I reckon he's probably been paid enough to shut up.
That's the thing, you know, those non-disclosure agreements that they sign and then their mouths are shut forever. So one can only wonder what that payout might have entailed. But, you know, definitely, especially if you look at something like a possible commission of inquiry later, which the courts have to decide on now, they're going to be forced into a corner now. The likes of Hawa are going to be so, so important. And I mean, that's going to be a situation where if you subpoena to something like that, unfortunately, you know, you can't keep silent any longer.
I'm also interested in what kind of a psychological effect this has on the people in the Zuma compound when you hear about, you know, they're basically being portrayed as being puppets and being agents for the Guptas. I mean, does this not bother the president's a strong man.
Mm.
He's a guy who's kind of had to fight his own battle in many cases without any support. There was a time when no one would side with the president.
Yeah.
He was alone in the wilderness. And now he's back in and he's the president of South Africa.
Mm.
And we hear he gets annoyed when people say the Guptas, the Guptas, the Guptas. But he seems to tolerate it because he needs the money. Is there not some ego element here that we're missing? Is there not something that he has on them?
Yeah.
I mean, there's got to be reciprocity there too.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think if you consider, you know, President Jacob Zuma's background, we seem to forget that President Zuma is essentially a spy. That's his background. That's where he comes from. You know, he let the ANC's exiled intelligence operations, you know, outside of the country during the struggle era. So President Jacob Zuma, and if you look at, once again, sort of the outcome of this weekend's NEC meetings, how time and time again, Mr. Teflon manages to step out of there unscathed, you know, that has to indicate to some extent that he does keep a file on quite a vast number of people, of some of their misdemeanors. He's not the only person with skeletons in his closet.
But he probably knows where the money is. I mean, like, he knows who's been paid and how much.
He does. And I think the frightening thing is that
he's keeping his own set of books, basically.
Yes, and unlike the others, President Zuma has access to something like the State Security Agency and its operatives. And, I mean, we've personally worked on stories where there are very clear indications that pockets of the SSA has been sort of exclusively been developed into these pro-Zuma operating units that get involved with these very politically motivated things, you know, that no longer concern state security. So,
I mean, they mustn't. That NEC, I would imagine, they all put their phones into an envelope, they say, and they go into the NEC. You don't have any devices on you. But those devices are being monitored anyway. Because the president needs to know. I bet you every single person in the NEC, no matter how powerful or how rich or how influential or how important, when they think they're not being watched, the president knows everything. They know, he can see every WhatsApp message. He can hear every call. And he knows who's cheating on him behind his back.
So it's not just insecure girlfriends who are monitoring their partner's devices. It's the president too. Oh, yes.
He
monitors everyone.
I believe so, absolutely. Yeah. And that includes the Guptas, certainly.
Oh, he's probably got stuff on them.
Yeah, it's not a cordial relationship, and it's not a real friendship, let's be honest.
No.
These guys are using one another. And Zuma, ever the cunning strategist, definitely has a very comprehensive packet of information on his friends at Saxonwold.
If you take the iceberg theory, the tip and all of that, I mean, how much do you think we as South Africans know currently about what's really going on?
I think actually very little. I think it's going to require something on the level and scale of the Panama Papers that we saw last year. Our version of the Panama Papers, where we really start seeing how the outflows, the financial outflows to tax havens like the Bahamas and Dubai's and those kind of places, to actually understand how much money is being siphoned off from these government contracts and end up in these lovely bank accounts in these tropical locations across the world.
Tell me, how did the Guptas get so good at this? I mean, you know, part of me, I said earlier, is begrudgingly, I'm kind of an admirer of the fact. I like the criminal behavior and the fact that they've completely ridden roughshod over South Africa and its sovereignty.
Yeah.
But you've got to sort of admit the business brain behind all of this is pretty impressive.
Yeah, sort of the Machiavellian and the strategy aspects of their dealings is quite
extraordinary. There's something to be admired.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, there's a term I unfortunately forget now. It's an Indian word that basically denotes a business strategy that's quite common on the subcontinent where it's quite normal to have these kind of greasy, very close relations with people in power. So obviously, you know, it's a little bit more universal than something that only occurs in India or South Africa, but it's very much, I think, you know, part of the business strategy of a lot of top-level Indian government, business people. So I think it's something they learned over there. Their father was a shrewd businessman himself. He sort of set up a couple of companies that eventually, you know, enabled them to get a bit of seed funding together to come over to South Africa. So I think, yeah, I think that in terms of the cozying up with those in power strategy, I think that's something they probably learned from the father.
And what's how close do you get to Saxonwold?
Well, you can.
Do we know what happens in there? Yeah. You know?
At what point do they start shooting at you when you get too close?
Well, there's a journalist who tried to cover a Diwali festival event the other day, and she was manhandled a little bit, but fortunately, nobody's shot yet. But yeah, I take a little detour past there once in a while, and it's, yeah, the street is open. You can drive past there, but obviously, a very well guarded compound itself, so you can't get in there.
How many people live in there?
I think it kind of varies between 15 and 20, apparently, when they are here. They definitely
Where do they spend most of their time?
It looks like they're becoming increasingly scattered. There is a house in Cape Town, and now there's a big base in Dubai as well, where I believe the youngest brother, Rajesh, spends a lot of his time and kind of looks after the Gupta's interests in Dubai. But then it certainly looks like there was a brief period where the family kind of disappeared off the scenes. But it appears that Atul and Ajay Gupta, the kind of the main role players in the family, they seem to be largely back at Saxon World at this stage.
And they clearly don't have a problem. Like, they go to the shops, they do normal stuff, people see them around. I've heard people saying, oh, they're just... These guys, they're shameless. They're like, with one hand, they're busy actively corrupting the state. And with the other hand, they're kind of walking around like celebrities.
Absolutely. You know, you can find them at the Sand and Diamond Walk, where some of the wives apparently like to spend quite a lot of money on Saturday afternoons. Yeah, huh. So if you want to go do some Gupta watching.
Wow.
But yeah, they still, I mean, they're very publicly. And once again, you know, just kind of like points to the... the absolute shamelessness of all of this. They attended a Diwali festival event with President Zuma the other day, which he also attended very publicly. So they seem to have reached a point where they don't care anymore.
Just don't give a shit. Yeah. Well, that maybe started with Watercliffe, and you go into that in quite a big way in your book. Mm. Let's just talk about how that whole thing happened, because it's still unbelievable to me that a military installation was used as a private airport terminal for a wedding.
Yep. Absolutely. Yeah, that kind of, yeah, that's the brazenness
and
of it.
And nobody went to jail. Mm. I mean, you would have been court-martialed in any other country if you were military, you know, in the military hierarchy, and you allowed this to happen in some way.
Yeah, yeah. So I think that's why the sort of the Waterkloof developments were so important, I believe, because it was such a watershed moment because of the fact that they showed for the first time to the country. You know, all of us sat upright and sort of realized how much power these guys exert.
Yeah.
To pull that off can only mean that you have access to the very highest, you know, top echelons of government. And we learned that from the saga. You know, there was the first reference to number one came from the Waterkloof development, where, you know, one of the sort of lower ranked essay in the F officers who later, you know, became one of the fall people for this whole thing. She referred to, you know, number one having authorized it. And we all know what that means now. In fact, later on in one of the board inquiries, she for the first time sort of revealed that, yes, number one is a sort of code word for the president for safety purposes. So, yeah, Waterkloof is so important for us to understand that, you know, I think it took quite long for something like that to break, actually, because we know that they got the clause in government way earlier. But it was important to sort of realize for the first time, you know, how powerful they actually became.
How much time does the president spend thinking about this stuff and interacting with the Guptas as opposed to being president of the republic?
That's a very good question. That is such a good question because, you know, obviously holding the highest office in the land requires a lot of
loads
input.
Of responsibilities.
Yeah, there's foreign diplomacy, there's the economy, there's so much. And yet, time and time again, we learn of these late night visits to Saxon World.
Yeah, he prioritizes this above all else. I mean, ministers don't know that they're in or out.
Definitely.
But the Guptas know they're going to get what they want.
Yeah, so once again, I think, like, unfortunately, you know, the manner in which the country is governed at the moment kind of answers your question. Because President Zuma is not a very hands-on president. We have a situation where our joblessness, you know, and unemployment is just growing. And his government doesn't seem to have a very effective strategy for that, apart from this radical economic transformation that they just can't seem to employ or roll out without merely benefiting their closest friends. So maybe he doesn't even really care about being an effective and a good president, I suppose.
How does Russia come into all of this?
The Russians are very hungry for the nuclear deal. And that is, interestingly, it's a interest in nuclear that started taking root at the same time that the Guptas got into nuclear too, when they bought their Shiva uranium mine in the Northwest province. So I think increasingly we're going to probably see indications of an alignment in terms of the outcome of the nuclear deal between the Russians and the Guptas. The Guptas are probably going to be deal makers in the rollout of the nuclear strategy. And the Russians, yeah, without probably revealing too much of current sort of ongoing investigations, they definitely seem to have already parted with some money to ensure that the right lobbying efforts are rolled out so that one day the nuclear deal does come their way. Yeah, and the Guptas and the Russians are definitely going to be hand in hand in this deal if it does come out.
And
yeah,
this is going to make the arms deal look like small fry.
It is, yeah,
in terms of the amount of money.
The estimates range between 500 billion rand and a trillion rand. That's a 1,000 billion rand. if you start breaking it down like that.
Wow.
You know, so yeah, absolutely small scale stuff. The arms deal, okay, it obviously happened in the 1990s, so you know, inflation would have been,
sure.
But at current value is probably about 70 billion. So the arms deal would be less than a tenth of the nuclear deal if it does reach that 1 trillion rand amount.
And we know that this is important because we've had two finance ministers fired over it.
Exactly. Those who oppose the deal are shown the door. That seems to be the case. You know, Shansha Nene, you know, he's already indicated that he opposed a lot of the Eskom dealings, and he was shown the door. We know where Pravin Gordhan stands in terms of nuclear, because the key thing always here is going to be affordability. There are a lot of studies done, you know, that currently, one, that show that we do not need that much nuclear power, and two, that, you know, our fiscus simply cannot carry the burden.
So this is the big payday. This is what they've been building up to.
That's the end game. That's the end game.
So what if, foreseeably, it's all going according to plan right now? I mean, certainly this NEC over the weekend, everyone's saying, oh, no, they're going to throw him out. He won.
Yeah.
The president came out again, and he's still got his hands on the reins.
Absolutely.
Now, if, let's imagine, something happens, there's going to be some catastrophic event, something's going to take place, which is entirely possible, and the president and the Guptas lose out on this deal. What happens then? What's their best case scenario if this deal doesn't get pulled off?
I think if that happens, I'd be more comfortable with being a Gupta than being President Jacob Zuma. I think the Guptas, it's going to be easier for them to simply, you know, gather the rest of the clan and fly over to Dubai where they've already established a base.
Mm.
We've learned from the weekend emails that Zuma certainly is interested in
having an
following
escape plan.
In there, exactly, and also actually, you know, going over to Dubai where his friends are staying. But I think it's going to be so much more difficult for him, you know, being a sitting president. So the second thing to consider is, once again, like, you know, I've mentioned growing rumors and indications that the Russians have already parted with some money to ensure that nuclear happens. President Vladimir Putin and his administration is one that does not shy away from acting against those who do not dance to their fiddle. There have been critics of President Putin who's been killed in Moscow. Yep. We know that. And
polonium sandwich.
Exactly. So I believe if it doesn't happen, you'd probably sit with a very nervous President Jacob Zuma.
The first time he'll be nervous in a long time because he seems impervious to that kind of thing.
Let him break a sweat. Jeez.
Yeah. When it comes to other kind of business interests these guys have together, there's a lot being spoken of with regard to Eskom, and you said earlier it's the piggy bank.
Mm.
But these mines that basically Glencore was strong-armed into selling.
Yeah.
Have you been able to dig up any more dirt on all of that since then?
Very interesting enough, so the weekend's emails also contain quite a lot on that development, and we'll certainly learn more. I think it's going to be important to get more details on what exactly was Mosabenzi Zwane doing in Switzerland, you know, with Glencore's CEO and with the Guptas. And we now know that they denied this, but they flew together. They flew on the Guptas' private plane. There was a trip in that very same time frame to India, and one can only wonder what that was about. All of them traveled together. So the Glencore saga, it's a frightening manifestation of state capture, because it involved so many different state entities, literally sort of pushing this international company into a corner and forcing their hand in terms of selling the mine to the Guptas.
The Guptas were doing so well in keeping a low profile for such a long time. Mm. I mean, they've been in deep with the president for a long time.
Yeah.
And we can go into that Thabo Mbeki stuff in a moment, but I'm fixated on their relationship with the current president because it's more important for what's happening at the moment. It was really two things that brought them out into the open. Mm. It was the Watercliff situation with the wedding, and it was Thuli Madonsela's report.
Mm. Yeah, no,
but
definitely.
Before then, we wouldn't have known much about them. Nobody was talking about the Guptas 5 years ago.
Yeah, they managed to fly under the radar.
Yeah, they must be kicking themselves that these two things happened. Yeah. Definitely. That stupid wedding, we shouldn't have allowed it.
Yeah, I go back to, I keep on referring to this movie, American Gangster. I'm clearly a fan. Yeah. But there's a scene where, Denzel Washington's character, they advise him not to wear like a very flashy jacket to one of these high-profile boxing matches where all these sort of celebrities and gangsters were gathering. Because the FBI was watching and the cops and stuff, you know, and I think that's to an extent what happened, you know, to the Guptas too. They couldn't resist the temptation to become increasingly sort of like exactly brazen in their exploits, especially with Waterkloof. That was a calculated risk, or that was one that didn't pay off for them.
Because the smart move is to just keep it quiet, keep it on the DL. You've got all your money, you've got massive influence. Yeah, nobody knows. Yeah. You're in the perfect position.
I mean, do you have to land at Waterkloof? Can't you just let the guys land at Our Tambo or Lanseria and just let them get off and go to the wedding?
But nobody reports on all the planes that come in and out of Lanseria.
Exactly. But I think it just points to, you know, they enjoy having that much power, I think. They wanted to show their sort of friends and family back in India, we pretty much effectively running this country. Look at us landing you guys at a military site.
Who runs the world?
looking forward to that rendition of that one.
Yeah,
it's true.
So I think that's where you know, and it's always in these kind of situations where you have powerful people who become increasingly powerful. You know, they eventually find themselves in a situation where they almost become victims of their own power. You know, they can't resist showing it off. And there's always, you know, it's almost certainly going to end in, you know, in exposure at the end for them.
Is that because the more power they attain, the more invincible they feel?
I think so.
And then they start to think, well, I'm going to do whatever I want.
Yeah. I think it's definitely a massive ego thing. Mm. You know, it's definitely an ego thing. I think they firmly believe that they do run the country. There's no doubt in their minds.
Yeah.
So, you know, keeping it under wraps and in the shadows probably becomes more difficult in the first place after a while, but it's also not that much fun. I mean, if you are running the country, you want to show it to somebody, I suppose, especially your friends and family back home. And then that obviously snowballs into a massive public outcry and scandal.
What's the biggest threat to this captured state of theirs? What could rumble them? What could really cause the cards to fall apart?
I think rival captors or would-be captors, definitely. They're not the only ones who sort of employ these strategies, definitely.
Who
not.
Else do we have?
Some of the guys who have been reported on in the past. I mean, you look at a guy like Roy Moodley, who's a very prominent businessman and former ANC councillor from KwaZulu-Natal. He's been making vast amounts of money from companies like Prasa, for instance.
Yeah.
You get the likes of Vivian Reddy, also a very powerful businessman.
Mm-hmm. In KZN as well.
And then there's just an absolute myriad of sort of smaller scale guys who also make a lot of money. I mean, I call them smaller, but you know, they're still multi-millionaires or billionaires in some instances. It's just, you know, in comparison to the Guptas, their exploits and wealth is a little bit smaller. But there's a network of state captors active in South Africa, and I think that's the issue about state capture. I've never wanted to close a chapter on the topic of state capture with a book on the Guptas. I think it should actually be the start of the conversation. The Guptas, just coincidentally, they're probably at the pinnacle of the state capture network as we see it now. But there are so many other role players that we have to look
at. So they're rival things that could spoil it for them. What else?
I think that definitely. I think a change in the political winds. I think the exit of or possible exit of President Jacob Zuma and his failure to put in place somebody after him that is favorable to the Guptas and to his sort of interest. I think that could definitely also land them in a situation where something like criminal prosecution becomes a reality.
Yeah.
Because right now, the revelations over the last couple of years have definitely unearthed a lot of prosecutable issues. You know, they've transgressed the law of this land, the Public Finance Management Act and such. And the Hawks and the NPA is simply not interested in following up on that at the moment, because state capture extends beyond just these state-owned companies in the president's office.
Yeah, it goes
now
into
seeps into the NPA and the Hawks
We've
too.
We've seen so that.
I think that's also a very real threat to them. I think that's probably something they increasingly starting to, especially, you know, with a growing sentiment within the ruling party itself, this growing opposition to state capture and the way in which Zuma's running this country. I think prosecution and possibly, you know, imprisonment is also something they should probably fear.
Who else would go to jail? There are a lot of people.
If that actually finally happens one day, you know, when we start prosecuting people for corruption, which is so needed in this country as a deterrent, then you're going to start seeing the whole network possibly, you know, being looked at by the NPA and the Hawks. If you look at what happened at PRASA recently, Lucky Montana.
What's happened to him?
Oh, he's just he's in the shadows, definitely off this sort of out of the main political spotlight.
But he got out with a lot of money, right?
Well, if you look at he bought 50 million rands worth of properties cash that we know of. That's a couple we looked at. And in some of those cases, there were very real indications of involvement of companies at one PRASA contract.
Were you the person he threw a brick at?
That's me.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah. So
that's me.
Did he see you and start swearing at you and pick up a brick and throw it at you?
He did, yeah. So he basically,
that's
nice summary of it. Yeah. So he actually, well, contrary to how he sort of tweeted, how he's very active on Twitter, interestingly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
how,
so, you know, so a
journalist comes to his private house, and, you know, that's like a, you know, in a way I can maybe like understand that sentiment, but it was a building site. It was just one of his many, many sort of building projects and residential homes that he's managed to amass. And he only later, because I went again, we had a very specific tip off on how some of these contractors were linked to PRASA and they were sort of like supplying the tiles and sort of building the house for him. And then he actually only pitched up there later. I was already there for a while and then saw me on site and then stormed in. And I asked one of his friends who was standing outside I just want to put a question to him, like a media query. And then he stormed out with his brick and he just chucked it at the car. Luckily, the car window was actually open, but I managed to already sort of drive away and then he hit the back of the car. Yeah,
did almost you at least institute a claim?
We did like a charge at the police station. that didn't end up in prosecution.
God, unbelievable.
Yeah.
So how did Thabo Mbeki, because the Thabo Mbeki Foundation strongly criticized your assertion in your book when it came out.
Yeah.
That he had anything to do with the Guptas.
Mm.
He wants it to be known that he didn't, these were not his people, but that's not true.
It's not true. You know, I think it just, once again, you know, President Thabo Mbeki is somebody who has become a bit of a history revisionist, especially when it concerns his own legacy. You know, we know those letters that he's been writing on sort of certain factors of his or aspects of his presidency that have come under fire.
Zimbabwe, ARVs, yeah.
Yeah, so I find it very interesting because, you know, it's not something that's been alleged. This is information that, you know, a very close associate of his actually, after a bit of sort of prodding, finally gave to me. That would be Esop Bard. I interviewed him on two different occasions throughout 2016. The first time, he curiously didn't mention anything about this consultative council. And then only afterwards, I found a video of Ajay Gupta at one of these, the New Age press briefings or the New Age breakfast events, where he said that he met, because he was talking, somebody asked him, you know, how did you guys become so close to President Zuma and where did all of this start? And he sort of very candidly spoke about this consultative council that he was part of that used to meet at the presidential guest house in Pretoria. And at that sort of like unguarded moment, he actually gave away much more than Zuma, than President Thabo Mbeki ever wanted to be revealed, because the fact that he was on the consultative council was not known at that stage. That was the first time anybody let slip. So ironically, you know, my main source on that story is Ajay Gupta. And then I went back to, because I couldn't pick up any indications of Ajay Gupta's involvement in this consultative council. And I asked some of the, because he was also on the International Marketing Council, which is totally above board, sort of a tourism and marketing entity. And I asked them if they ever met at the presidential guest house. And they said, no ways. You know, they had their standard meetings in Johannesburg or in Cape Town, never at the presidential guest house. And then I went back to Esop Bard and I asked him, but listen, so Ajay Gupta, you know, he very openly said that he was on the consultative council. And then he finally said that, yeah, okay, he became a member in about 2006. So he was very much in the Mbeki fray too.
did the Guptas have anything to do with the way that Thabo Mbeki was pushed out?
I've got a chapter on that, on Polokwane 2007. And, yeah, it's, you know, a book such as this, as opposed to, I think, like an investigative piece, it also allows for a little bit more informed speculation. Mm. And what I have done in one of the chapters is, I call this very curious, Tokia Sekgwale played a key role in ousting President Thabo Mbeki at Polokwane 2007. He was one of the actual sort of contenders to become ANC president. Yep. It was him, Mbeki, and Zuma. And then at a very curious juncture, he just completely abandoned his campaign and threw his weight behind Zuma. And I built a little bit of a timeline around that because I sort of found out that his company, Mabangela Investments, became a shareholder in Sahara Computers in 2005. So he's pulled into the Gupta business fraternity in 2005. And then in 2007, he plays this very key role in seeing to it that Zuma triumphs over Mbeki at Polokwane, which I find very interesting.
Machiavellian is the word.
I think so. Yeah.
Well, listen, it's a terrific book. And I suggest that anybody who cares about what's going on at the moment or is interested in figuring out the long history of the Gupta family and the ANC, and whether it was Thabo Mbeki in the beginning, Jacob Zuma now, or at any other juncture, what they've done to establish themselves as such powerful players in South Africa. It's all in the book, The Republic of Gupta, The Story of State Capture. Peter Louis Myburg, thank you so much for coming to speak to us.
Thanks for having me.
Sure.
Great.
We'll talk again soon, I'm sure. Yep. There'll be more revelations, right?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
I can't wait to hear what else you've got in that big tranche of documents that you've got. It's exciting stuff.
It'll be fun to work through.
Yeah. All right, here's what you need to know. The ANC-NEC is concluded. After much criticism and unwanted attention, Jacob Zuma had the following to say. Don't push me because I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. More and more Gupta emails are being leaked. They're all of a detailed business nature with strict instructions to all the role players involved in state capture. The most eye-catching, however, are the ones directed to Colin Oros Maine, where he was taught how to talk to the media with the help of Barney the Dinosaur videos. And finally, the Proteas snatched another defeat from the jaws of victory, this time against England in the must-win second ODI. Coach Russell Domingo was quick to downplay the loss as a failure, though. As the team, they didn't want to go into the Champions Trophy as favourites, so they picked Farhan Behadin, and with that they were guaranteed to lose without it looking like match-fixing. Have a good Monday. We will see you tomorrow, bright and early, 6 a.m. CliffCentral.com.